You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is assistant professor of English at Mount Aloysius College, host of the Sectarian Review podcast, and potential Kwisatz Haderach, Danny Anderson. Danny, the first question I have to ask you, well, two introductory questions. First, did I pronounce that correctly?
I was going to say, I'm probably going to mispronounce every word in this book. Like, I'm sure that there are like aficionados out there who are going to be correcting every pronunciation I make. So that's what I was coming up with, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's how they did it in that movie, which we don't speak of. But I'm not entirely sure. So that's one question. And then the second question is the last book episode that you and I did was on the Sacred Scroll of the Seven Seals. Which book is more insane, Dune or the Sacred Scroll of the Seven Seals?
I think the Sacred Scroll of Seven Seals is about as insane as a book gets. It's the pinnacle of crazy conspiracy theory mixed with religion and like fundamentalist kind of religion at that. And so, yeah, I would say that Dune is at least artful. This is
Dune is better written than
absolutely. That's the difference. Yeah, here. No question about it.
And that I suppose gives it away. We're going to be talking about Frank Herbert's 1965 book Dune, which has sort of an interesting history in and of itself. And I will have to restrain myself from going too much into the publication on this because it's just fascinating. Anything you want to say off the bat before we jump into the book on this, Danny? Otherwise, we'll dig in.
I was going to ask you what prompted this idea and why me, I suppose. because we've been talking about that. I have to apologize publicly to Coyle because he's been asking me to do this since like winter break of 2017, I think. And I started the book and then I got caught up with other things and it took me forever to finish it. And then other scheduling things came up. And so here we are 6 months later, finally getting to the episode. So I want to apologize for taking so long, to get this done. But I was always curious as to what prompted this as an episode for you.
Yeah, well, honestly, I had been rereading it for fun over Christmas break last year, and at the same time, I was reading The Sacred Scroll of the Seven Seals, so I figured you owed me after we recorded that episode. I was like, you know what? I'm going to get my revenge, and we're going to do Dune, and it's going to be a better book. I don't think it'll be a better episode necessarily, but it'll be a better book.
Yeah, this is not equal repayment. I mean, Dune is actually a pleasure to read. That thing was a slog, so... Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, that thing was like 100 pages, and this is what, 700? Something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, almost 8. Yeah, it was, So.
Which is impressive given that it's a work of science fiction. Right, I have to say a little bit about its publication history, and then I'll ask you to give us the entire plot in 2 minutes or less, Danny.
Okay, I'll do my best.
So Frank Herbert, he was a West Coaster, specifically in Washington State, spent a little bit of time in D.C. as a speechwriter. While in D.C., he watched the Army McCarthy hearings. Apparently, Joseph McCarthy was even a distant relation of Frank Herbert. He then returned to Washington and spent years as a freelance writer, working especially on, of all things, a story about the USDA and its attempts to stop the spread of sand dunes from going too far inland and destroying the landscape. And he got to watch them plant this. I forget the name of what it is. Some kind of British coastal grass to keep the dunes from eroding, being washed too far inland. Which today this grass is now considered an invasive species, and they're trying to kill it off. But of course, Herbert didn't know that at the time. This got him very interested in ecology and planned environmentalism, and eventually caused him to start researching deserts and desert cultures. He then eventually wrote this article about the USDA that he'd written into a couple of short stories, which he published as stories called "They Stopped the Moving Sands." He felt like he had more to say. He hadn't quite finished this, so he combined these short stories into two long novels. One of these novels was 400 pages, and one was more than 600 pages. These were Dune and Dune Messiah. He then started shopping these novels around to publishers. At the time, in the mid-60s, the prevailing wisdom was that the market for science fiction is short stories, not long novels. There were exceptions, but basically only Robert Heinlein had really made it in any meaningful sense as a science fiction novelist. There are some others here and there. You know, Ray Bradbury was publishing at the time, but even then, they're most of the science fiction writers are primarily doing short stories. So Herbert shopped it around to something like 20 different publishers before he finally found one willing to roll the dice on it, a publisher called Chilton. And when I first was reading the story about the publication, that sort of rung a bell in the back of my head. Chilton was known for publishing car manuals and parts catalogs. So I grew up with in the shop on the ranch I grew up on a row of shelves in the shop with Chilton in giant letters on the side, and I remember that's where I'd seen it from. They hit it big with this one. You know, most of those things they don't make any money on. They just sort of put them out. Dune becomes the best-selling science fiction novel ever. And one of only two mainstream science fiction works to sort of break into the snobby literary canon, along with Watchmen. So Dune and Watchmen are sort of the two that have made it. Meaning that if you draw up a list of, you know, the 50 best science fiction novels and a list of the 50 best novels of the 20th century, Dune and Watchmen are basically the only two that are going to be regularly on both lists, depending on how we count the dystopian classics, right?
Yeah.
Brave New World and so on. So that's, again, I think it's just a fascinating publication history. It went through a lot to even get out into the world as a novel. Once it was there, this is sort of the book that if you're only ever going to read one science fiction novel, this is the book you ought to read. I don't think it's the book you should start with if you think you might read more than one, but if you're only going to read one, if you know yourself and you know that's the sort of person you are, then this is the one you ought to go with. Danny, what happens in Dune? You don't have to restrict yourself to 2 minutes, but tell us, just give us a quick plot overview of the book.
Well, it's a big magisterial plot, right? And so it's a kind of a political court drama as much as anything else. And so, and it takes place over many, many years of the escalation of this kind of plot. So you have this planet called Arrakis, which is home to this special substance that everybody in the universe covets and wants. It's called spice, basically. The people who live there are these kind of wild people called Freemen or Freemen. I'm not sure how the aficionados are going to pronounce that, but I was saying Freemen myself. Doomed to live on this planet where there's almost no water. They have to, all of their existence basically is the preservation of every little ounce of water that they can preserve. And they have these special suits that they wear called still suits, which collects all the sweat and any kind of bodily excretion you can imagine and recycles it so that you can actually drink your recycled water. It's the only way to survive on this planet. So water takes on this rather mystical quality. It becomes really their economy. But for everybody else, all they're interested in is spice. And so the emperor, there's this political, I guess the organization of the universe is there's this emperor of the known universe, and there are five great houses. And so you kind of almost have a mafioso sort of setup here. You have these
or feudal, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
feudal. To put the positive spin on it.
Yeah, let me say that. Yeah, but well, with the intrigue, and I guess there was a lot of that going on in medieval times as well. But
sure.
You have assassins and all this kind of thing. So these five great houses are basically in competition for power within the universe, and the emperor comes from one of these five great houses, and so you have this kind of scenario where he's not entirely autocratic. You have this scenario in which he also depends on the goodwill and the political favors of the heads of the other houses. And so the two main houses that we're actually interested in are the Atreides house, which is led by Duke Leto Atreides, and then the Harkonnens, who are the bad guys. The Atreides are the good guys. The Harkonnens are the bad guys, who are led by Varen Vladimir, or somebody, some Russian name, I believe, of Harkonnen. So you definitely have a Cold War sort of vibe going on in here. And so there's some sort of intrigue between, a conspiracy between the Harkonnens and the Emperor to isolate the Atreides house on Arrakis, so that then the Harkonnen house can, through a very complicated set of political machinations, which I won't get into, basically destroy them by having them isolated on this little planet. And so, in the midst of doing that, the son of the Atreides house, whose name is Paul Atreides, he and his mother escape, and they become part of the Fremen culture, and he develops into this kind of messianic figure. He develops into this kind of religious cult figure that organizes the Fremen into this planetary-wide revolt that ends up kind of turning the order of the universe over on its head. And I don't know if I want to get to the ending of the book, but by the end of the book, should I do that?
The book's been out for 50 years.
Yeah, so by the ending of the book, Paul plays the political games well enough that he ends up installing himself as emperor of the universe, and basically the conspiracy is completely failed after a number of years in which it looked like it succeeded. But in the background of all of that is this really strange kind of religious mystical subplot that feeds the. It's almost a parallel plot. Paul's mother is not the wife, but the consort of Duke Atreides, and she's part of this religious order of women called the Bene Gesserit, I believe. Am I right about this? If I'm saying this right.
I have no idea.
And they're this sort of, like a mystical tradition that is trying to engineer the universe to create this messiah, right, through genetic manipulation. And they have all these kind of powers, basically. They're super wise. They have amazing fighting ability. They can use their voice to control people. They're quasi witches, and they get called witches quite a lot in the book. But Paul's mother Jessica kind of raises him with the eye that I'm trying to create the Messiah, basically, and it turns out to be true, right? And so as he's developing his political skill in the kind of material world of the known universe, there's also this kind of religious tradition that he's becoming aware of by his experience in that political world, and he does kind of merge the two, this religious vision of human organization and this political vision of human organization, into this messianic figure who is both religious leader and political leader of Arrakis the universe by the end of the book. So it's a really, and there are many, many subplots. There's a ton of characters in this book. I won't get into it, but just to keep it as simple as possible, that's the basic plot. And I'm sure there's some elements of that I've underscored or underplayed. What else should we know?
Oh man. I mean, it's such a complicated book, right? There's a reason it's, 600 to 800 pages, depending on the version you get. So yeah, I think you're right. There's the sort of open political side, which of course is only open because we're given kind of the inner thoughts of the people, because it's all conspiracy.
Yeah.
But then there's the religious side with the Bene Gesserit. I don't know how you say that. I think that's one of the most interesting parts of the book. Both the idea that their sort of outward power is that they can control people with their voice.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that idea that religion has the ability just using words to control people. But there's also the idea that they have this sort of internal, and Herbert leaves it very vague as to whether or not this is some kind of psychic power or is there a psychological, physiological explanation where they're somehow all connected to each other.
Yeah.
Both the ones who live now and all of the ones who've lived in the past. So the heads of this order, they all have the ability to draw on the accumulated wisdom of the ages, which is, you know, a very sort of Roman Catholic view of what the Pope is doing, right?
Yeah.
And then they're using their sort of subtle behind the scenes religious work, like you said, to build up towards the creation of this Messiah, which is a male version of what all of these Bene Gesserit are doing. So the idea is that somewhere in, and again, I think it's unclear whether it's in every person or whether it's in this kind of collective memory, there's a place of the source of wisdom where women are not able to go, where only this single Messiah figure will be able to go. And the way you get there is by drinking what they call the water of life, which is... comes only from the planet of Arrakis. Again, there's yet another thing. So all these religious things going on, the Bene Gesserits have their long-term plan to create this Messiah. And then Lady Jessica sort of disobeys and breaks the plan, and bears a son instead of a daughter, as she was ordered to do she was ordered to bear a daughter to the Duke, and she bears a son instead because she genuinely loves him. And the result is all of their plans come true, but not in the way they want it. Right? They basically get everything they want, but it's not the way they wanted it. So it's unacceptable. So yeah, now we're thinking Pharisees in the New Testament, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the really interesting things. And so by bearing Duke Leto a son, who is Paul, who when he becomes this messianic figure among the Fremen, he takes on the name Muad'Dib, which is their language for the mouse, and there's some other name, Usul or something like that. He has all these kind of religious names that they assign to him. Muad'Dib is the big one, but by bearing him a son instead of a daughter, it's basically that's what you would do in a political. That's how political feudal societies, that's how the leadership is bestowed in those societies, right? The emperor, in the end, has no son. He has a daughter who is another Bene Gesserit, right? And so Paul's machination at the end is to arrange a marriage between himself and that daughter so that he becomes the emperor, right? And so it's interesting that the Bene Gesserit are seeking this kind of political order that transcends the material world, right? The material politics. They're trying to find this religious way to do this, but they end up using the successful version of this ends up using material political processes.
Right.
And I think that's something that this book is really interested in, is the way that our political processes change over time through unexpected events of history. And it's really kind of an interesting, this is probably why you love this book, is as someone who's interested in politics, it's a really fascinating thought piece on the way politics works.
Well, and I guess one other thing before we dig into some of the politics of it, the other group, so there's the empire, kind of the political discussion goes on with the emperor and the empire, and then the great houses, the religious side of things with the Bene Gesserit, and then there's the guild, right, representing sort of the commercial aspects of the book. They don't make as much of an appearance in Dune. From what I understand, they show up a lot more in some of the sequels. But the travel between planets, and we'll talk about this, I guess, technology is forbidden. Technology is mostly not allowed in this future world, especially computers. There's the prime directive, to steal the Star Trek language, is that you're not allowed to make a machine that thinks like a man. That's forbidden. So all thought goes on in the brain. So they have sort of developed logic and the powers of the human mind to their greatest potential. one sort of group of people who do that is the Guild, who are the people who control space travel. So if you want to get from one planet to another, the Guild has to transport you. And the way they do that is using spice, right? So, yeah. So again, it's this resource that's only found on the planet of Dune that the Guild relies on, that the Bene Gesserit rely on, and that the Emperor relies on, because it's, you know, he controls the planet of Arrakis. It's the source of his power also. I think in some ways this is a book that could not have been published basically after 1965. I mean, if you think about sort of the broad strokes of it, you have an imperial power fighting against a fundamentalist religious desert people who control the spice, you know, the resource that makes the world work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about as clear a metaphor for the Middle East as you could ever possibly have.
Yes.
And the religious fanatics are the good guys.
Yeah. There's a very Lawrence of Arabia quality to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And Paul is that kind of outsider who goes native. That's a phrase they use in the book quite a lot, and becomes kind of king of the natives and combines their indigenous wisdoms and traditions with this larger kind of political knowledge of the universe.
Right. Well, although one of the things we find, again, as, you know, plots within plots as this book goes along, is that a lot of the sort of indigenous native wisdom was planted there by the Bene Gesserit, right? So
yes.
So
as
one
a way,
of their
go ahead.
No. It's one of their functions is they want to make the universe safe for themselves, so they have more power. So way back in the distant past, they sent out missionaries to plant sort of super vague legends in the minds of all of these colonial peoples. They're colonial people. They're all human. There are no aliens in this book.
Right? Yeah.
These are people who'd spread across the universe, you know, in the distant past. And just very, very vague things like the savior will come from, you know, I don't even remember any of them, the husbandless wife or something like that. So that if a Bene Gesserit is ever lost or stranded, she can use these to seek help. Right? She can sort of play on these because they all know them and they know the details and they know them back and forth. Well, again, they sort of do this cynically with the goal of controlling people. The end result is still it all comes true.
Right? Yeah,
it literally ends up coming true, which isn't what they meant, but it's still what happens.
Yeah, and it's almost like so you have this kind of spiritual origin for this order, this Bene Gesserit order, that then becomes overwhelmed just by the institution of keeping the order going, right? Right. Reminds you of church, right?
Sure.
of the Christian church. And then it turns out the thing that they're just sort of doing mechanically is actually a real thing that's out of their control. And so you have the institution as necessary for propagating the religion, but at the same time, it's totally oblivious to the fact that it's actually propagating a religion, right? They think they're playing politics, but they're actually propagating a religion that actually has this kind of eschatological fruition here at the end of this book.
And
so,
right, and their goal is to create a messiah not for the sake of setting people free, but for the sake of pursuing their own power, right? A messiah that they can control.
Yeah.
And again, what is the Messiah supposed to be doing is yet another sort of subplot of the book, right? It is because one of the things that happens when, you know, Paul is able to look into whatever this mystical place is he sees visions of the distant future.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily pleasant, right? They're, like you said, eschatological, but not positive eschatological. They're jihad, and Herbert uses the word jihad, sweeping across the galaxy, and blood and death and destruction. And of course, he doesn't want to do this. But it's that challenge of if I don't take control and if I don't lead these people against the Emperor now, they're going to be wiped out. They'll be exterminated. If I do take control and do this, then jihad is the result, and it's blood and destruction for everyone. Did you have something to add?
No. I was waiting for you to transition to the first topic.
Oh yeah, and that question of seeing the future then raises that further question of, well, does he even really have a choice, right? Where does freedom fit in? If you've seen the future, you're now tied down, right?
Yeah.
If you've seen the future, it's going to happen. So does he even really have an option? And that becomes yet another subplot of, you know, is this even a legitimate choice, or is it just going to happen and it kind of doesn't matter what he does? So yeah, a few. I mean, there's a lot we could talk about this book. I want to start off with a categorical question. Is this book really science fiction? This is a book that has some sorts of technology, but even the technology that it has is technology that is regressive. So they have shields, right? And shields negate the use of projectile weapons.
Yeah.
Which means that you have to use swords and knives.
Yeah.
So, what do you think, Danny? Is this tech? I mean, obviously it's science fiction in one sense, but what do you think?
But absolutely, there is technology. The shields are electronic, right? They're not like physical metal shields.
Right.
They're
right.
Like a force field kind of, right? And you have the bad Baron from the Harkonnen clan. He's a huge fat guy, like Jabba the Hutt kind of. So he can't really support himself on his own weight. So he's always moving around with these what's called suspensors, which are, I'm assuming, some sort of device that he wears that helps his body carry his own weight, some sort of anti-gravity right. thing. So there is a kind of technology that's alien to us, right? But you're right, it almost reminds me of like steampunk, where sure. you have this kind of use of technology to recreate the past, kind of, right? Which I don't know that much about steampunk, but I do know that it's like it's almost like it's combining the future with the past, right? Basically, and that's kind of what this book does. In order to not let the technology overwhelm the political drama, right? So there is technology in here, but it's dialed down. So yeah, I think it counts as science fiction. But it's not hard science, right? I think this is what you call like a soft science fiction book.
And so in
a way that kind of like Star Wars is too. I mean, you have recognizable technology that's alien to us, but the technology isn't really what's driving those stories, right? Unlike Blade Runner or something by Philip K. Dick, anything by Philip K. Dick. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is what he wrote, but the movie version is Blade Runner. Those are all meditations about what technology is doing to us. Technology is foregrounded, in those stories. This is not so much. It's almost as a way to recreate the past as much as it is to predict where the future goes. So yeah, I think it counts as science fiction for sure, but more in the kind of fantasy end of it rather than, I mean, this, if the technology wasn't there, this would still be a great story. And I would still read this book if they had different versions of the same thing.
Right. Well, and there's also the question of ecology, which I was going to get to later, but maybe now's a good time. There are spaceships, but they're spaceships in that they contain people in space for a moment, but they don't fly across the light years, right? There's some kind of weird folding of space that goes on by these guild navigators using the spice.
Yeah.
And it happens on other planets, but that, in some sense, doesn't matter. Like you said, you could sort of imagine all of this going on one planet, just in a desert, as happens on Earth. the one thing that is, I think, more solidly in the realm of science fiction is this idea of planetary terraforming.
Yeah.
One of the goals of the how'd you say it? The Freeman?
Freeman is how I was saying it. It looks
yeah,
like
sure.
Freeman is kind of a little too obvious, since that's what I was saying, Freeman.
Right.
So, yeah. But because they are kind of unattached to
right.
larger political systems, so they have this very proletariat kind of feel to them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Although they're clearly not that. I mean, they're phenomenal warriors, which
yeah.
we'll get to that, too. So their goal is basically to make the planet livable, right? Right now, it's you can sort of scrape an existence, scrape by an existence. It's not a good living. It's not a pleasant living. The only people who have it well are the leadership, the invading leadership who come in and conquer the place and then brutalize the people there. Their goal is to turn the bulk of the planet into a much more pleasant living place, right? By collecting water, by storing it up, and then by releasing it in the proper way and at the right times to affect the ecology of the planet, to turn it into a greener, more livable planet.
Yeah. Yeah, it turned at one point in the book, Paul and Jessica, his mother, are being introduced to the Fremen world, they take them to this cave where there's just an ocean of water that they've collected but aren't using, right? For such a precious resource, they're utterly disciplined about this future project. This is water that is to be used when the time is right in order to accomplish the goal of this planetary engineer named Kynes, who's sort of their leader, basically.
Yeah, so there's that's where you start, I think, getting a little more into the science fiction side of it, and that's really what I think Herbert was primarily known for in the 60s, is the ecological stuff. I don't think it's nearly as interesting as the political and religious stuff that goes on, but I'm also not a child of the 60s, so that,
yeah,
we're kind of on the other side of the environmentalism movement. So
it's interesting though. You're talking about this as science fiction, and when I meant to get to this, and I guess maybe we're still on that question tangentially, I think about the ways in which this shows up in later things that are recognizably science fiction. Star Wars, like Tatooine, right, where they're moisture farmers, right? I mean, they're scratching out of living very much like on Dune, right? And I think that clearly has an inspiration in this book. I don't know that I've never read George Lucas saying that, but I mean, you can clearly see how that element of this book, that ecological element of this book, finds its way there. Interstellar is another sort of recent book where there's this kind of environmental crisis that inspires this kind of long-term, you know, rebuilding project. And so I think it is interesting. I think that it's I understand why it's not as interesting to you as the politics, because you're a political scientist, right? And that's the nature of your show. But I think it is, for someone who is interested in ecology, I think this book still is really, really powerful and prescient. But the only way it's got a very progressive feel to it politically then, because these are like long-term centralized plans. These are not free market solutions to changing the environment, right? I mean, it's very much against this free market solution. And so I think but that also gets into the realm of politics then. So there are ways in which the ecology and the politics intersect, I think.
Right. Well, and obviously the empire is also concerned with the ecology, but they are there to harvest the planet, right? To take the resources and remove them, whereas the Fremen they have these long term goals, but they're goals that involve stewardship, right? And shepherding the planet and slowly, cautiously, incrementally over time.
Yeah.
Knowing
that they won't see it, their children won't see it, their grandchildren won't see it, their grandchildren's grandchildren won't see it. They are thinking like literally 20 generations down the road before this actually comes to fruition, and yet they're utterly kind of dedicated to it. And so they've got this kind of religious template already built in that Muad'Dib comes in, Paul, and really kind of captures their imagination, religious political imagination that they have. And incidentally, another movie that just came to mind, we have not mentioned The Worms. The major point of this movie is that this desert planet is populated by these gigantic sandworms that are, I mean, I'm not talking about like snake size. These are like immense. They're hundreds of yards big. They're gigantic, right? And so the Fremen are able to sort of corral these and use them as transportation, but they also are very deadly and destroy a lot of the industrial work that's going on. But they're also responsible for actually making the spice. Their activity in the sand is actually what creates the spice. And so these giant worms are really important part of it. And I love the movie Tremors. And so
yes.
That movie also clearly has its roots in this book, right? And so this is a very important book. And so, yeah.
And like the Dune series, the sequels just get worse and worse and worse with Tremors.
It's true. Although I did see it's a TV series version of it with Kevin Bacon in it again. I saw a preview for it, and I can't remember if it's Hulu or Amazon or what, but I saw a preview for it, and it actually looks really good. And so, yeah, but the first Tremors movie is
oh, it's gold.
It's ageless. It's great. So, go ahead.
So there's the ecological side of things. I'm resisting the temptation just to dive right into the political stuff. Gender.
Yeah.
What's your feel for sort of gender roles in the future? I mean, do you he's jumping ahead. I mean, this is set 10,000 years in the future is the idea. So we're beyond technology. Religious conflict is to some extent largely over. Everyone shares a religion. Is your impression that women are equal in this society? I mean, what?
I think it's maybe complementarian. Could we put it that way? I know the Christian Feminist Podcast is interested in these issues. I wish your wife, for example, were here to contribute to this. Because I feel like they are not. I mean, the emperor's daughter will not be emperor, right? She has to marry Paul, who has to be emperor. Like, she's his ticket to being the emperor, even though it is her position that brings that power. So there is a sense in which this book is entirely not gender equal, right? And yet the women are held in like super respectful places by this male dominated society, right? And so this is why I'm wondering if the more metaphor, at least, of complementarianism might inform the way this is set up. I mean, it is set up. They're not necessarily only property. They are held with high regard. The Bene Gesserit are like mystical beings that everybody sort of worships, right? And Jessica, even though she is not the wife, the Duke purposefully doesn't marry her in order to keep the political option open. To another house might leave us alone because there could be a political marriage in the future. Jessica accepts this kind of subservient role, and in fact Paul takes a concubine himself in the second half of the book, and she's really his true love but won't be married, right? And so at the end of the book, now Jessica and her have this conversation about that, saying Paul's going to go off and marry the princess, but she's never really going to be the wife, right? You are the important one. And so there does seem to be this move, and I would love to see where this goes in the sequels. In a book that is about changing political structures, there does seem to be, at the end of this book, this opening for this changing of gender roles as well. Paul seems to be upending a lot of things, right? Yeah, I wouldn't say that the women or men are equal, but I think women are highly esteemed in this unequal structure.
Right. So, and again, there's that balance on the political side. The men have the political power. The men are the ones who are managing sort of all of the kind of public and even secret conspiracies, right? The shifting around of houses, the votes in the big Senate, whatever it's called. The women on the female side, the women are almost exclusively in control of religion.
Yeah,
right? They're other than this one Messiah figure, who's sort of the exceptional one, Paul, as we eventually find out. The religious structures are all controlled by women, and what we find is that they're actually subtly, and again with that long game in view, controlling even the political stuff. Right, so the original orders to Leto's concubine were that she was to bear a daughter, which, because she's a witch, she can do that. You know, she gets to pick the gender. And then they were going to marry his daughter to the son of the Harkonnens, and then the offspring of these two great houses would then be the Messiah.
Yeah.
So even there, yeah, the men think they're controlling all of these, making all of these political moves. In reality, it's the women who are sort of behind the scenes, driving even those using religion. And then, of course, it's the Lady Jessica who disobeys that, who sets all of this off as well. You look like you have a quote you want to read.
There's a moment when Paul... It's complicated to get into if you've not read the book, and so I highly recommend reading it. There's a certain poisonous water that you drink on the Fremen planet. So when Jessica, she's already this Bene Gesserit witch, right? But she's not sure that she's the one of prophecy, right? And so she has to drink this poison, essentially, to enter into this tradition fully and become the reverend mother, right, of the Fremen. And so she does this, goes through this process, and the way it's described is just beautiful and intricate and psychedelic. It's really
trippy.
It's very trippy. But she goes into her inner mind, basically, and sees the molecules, the molecular structure of the poison, and rearranges it and changes the poison into like giving water, life-giving water, right? And then she doesn't die. She actually takes on this tradition of memory of the Reverend Mother, which is like a – I couldn't tell if that's like an Arrakis-specific version of the Bene Gesserit high order, or if it's it's universal. I'm not really sure.
But it's really vague.
Yeah. Yeah, but she enters into that tradition. And so only a woman can do that, right? And so – and she's actually pregnant at the time and didn't know that. And so her daughter ends up being born – she got pregnant before Duke Leto was killed. He gets killed in this sort of attack on the – you know, there's a traitor in his midst, and he gets killed during this attack by the Harkonnens. But she's pregnant with his daughter, and his daughter is born as this kind of magical being. It's very strange. Recently on my show, Sectarian Review, we talked about Alan Moore's comic run on Miracle Man, and there's a magic baby kind of that's born in that story that very much reminds me of this too. And I can't help but wonder if Alan Moore wasn't inspired by Dune when he did that with that character. Could be a conference paper for somebody out there. But anyway, so it's only a woman that can survive this, unless it's the Messiah, the guy, the name that I can't pronounce. and so at one point near the end of the novel, Paul Muad'Dib decides, I need to find out if I am or not. I'm going to do it. And so he drinks this water, and he comes out of the trance with this new wisdom, because he is the Messiah. And he says something that complicates the gender. There is in each of us an ancient force that takes and an ancient force that gives. A man finds little difficulty facing that place within himself where the taking force dwells, but it's almost impossible for him to see into the giving force without changing into something other than man. For a woman, the situation is reversed. It's very kind of trippy and mystical, right? But it also, it seems like Paul has entered a transgender state, right? I mean, I think right. He's this sort of intergender figure at this point, and because he's transcended all of that kind of, right? And so I think that's another moment where gender becomes really, really super interesting in this book.
Yeah, and it's been long enough since I've read it. I don't remember what the gender relations are amongst the Fremen, right? So I know that the women have to be as tough as the men because they have to survive in the same society.
Yeah.
And I think they're expected to fight in combat also.
They do. They throw their babies at attackers, in fact. Yeah. Right. It's a vicious fighting style. Yeah.
But I don't remember like if there's, you know, any political equality beyond that, or so maybe when Paul upends things, is he just bringing this sort of Fremen egalitarianism, if we're going to use those terms,
yeah,
to the Empire? I don't remember.
There's at one point early on in Paul's experience with the Fremen, he kills a Fremen in ritual combat, right? And when he gets back to home base or whatever, his woman is offered to Paul, and he can either take her as a servant or as a woman, right? And he chooses to take her as a servant, and she becomes this very supportive figure for the rest of the book in raising his children with another person. And so there is that sense in which she was kind of – she needed to be somebody's property, right? I mean, she had to be under some man's control within the Fremen society. And that's another thing I think Paul seeks to change a little bit right. As he changes a lot of the practices of the kind of a primitive social practices of the Fremen. That's one of the things that he does is he changes a lot of these things by saying it's a different time. And so, I think the gender roles are really complicated, and I think everybody will find something to love and everybody will find something to hate about this book if you're sort of committed to any kind of particular ideology about gender. This is a very complex vision of it.
Right. So there you go, Christian feminists. We'll turn it over to you guys from here on out. Imperialism. I mean, this is it's very very groundbreaking for its ecology, but really I think it has its staying power because of its commentary on politics, and particularly on the combination of ecology, of environmentalism, of sort of observations on human nature, of religion, of imperialism, and of military and education. I mean, there's all sorts of things that come together in this sort of overarching political commentary that as with many great books, doesn't come to a settled conclusion, but makes observations, I think, that are very challenging. One of which is the idea that that the emperor has power because he has this fearsome military force.
Yeah.
The Sarduker. I don't know if I'm saying that right either.
Yeah.
But this sort of elite force that comes from the Hell planet, whose name I'm not remembering.
Yeah, it's like a prison planet, basically. Yeah.
Right. So the idea is you go there as a prisoner and you get beaten into shape and you come out as this well trained, well tuned military machine.
60% don't survive. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And none of the other houses have anything that can match that. So the emperor, yes, there are some restraints on him. Maybe all of them together can stand up against this military force that he controls. But any one of them who goes up against him is going to be defeated. Well, the Fremen, of course, are raised on their own planet, right? Their own hell planet, and as a result, they're even tougher. So yeah. Eventually, the Sarduker get brought onto Arrakis, and there's some kind of military conflict between, it's like a legion of Sarduker, with 1,000 of them fighting this little battalion of Fremen, and the Fremen walk away from it saying, "Man, those guys are really tough. They killed 3 of us."
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of respect for these people who we killed 1,000 of, and they only killed 3 of us, despite us being massively outnumbered. The idea, and this is a common theme in mid-20th century science fiction, this question of how do we raise the next generation to be as tough as the previous generation? Right, so we think of the World War II generation, you know, the greatest generation, went through the Great Depression, went through World War II, you know, horrendous circumstances that basically few people in the world today will ever experience. But as a result of that, they were genuinely competent and virtuous and hardworking, and all of those sort of ideal things that we want to be. So that is actually one of the ways in which I think it is okay to sort of look at the 1950s and be like, you know what, there is something there to be emulated. It's not kind of the stereotypical American way of life of, you know, a family and 2 cars and a house and all that. It's this character that's built through suffering. Well, in the 50s and 60s, science fiction writers especially are asking, look, how can we recreate that for the next generation? We don't necessarily want to brutalize our children, right? But if that's necessary for raising another generation, what does that mean, right? And Herbert's way of examining that is, well, you end up in this circumstance where you're made tough, right? Paul comes of age in the desert, mm-hmm. not on his home planet of Caladan, I think.
I think that's right.
Which is a very pleasant, a beautiful planet, oceans everywhere. I mean, it's very much held up as an Eden. He's sent out into the desert where he has to learn how to survive. Of course, he has great training. He's the son of a duke, so he's taught how to fight. He's given the sort of mental skills of the people who have replaced computers. He's taught by his mother the ways of the Bene Gesserit, so he has this the potential to be able to control people with his voice as well. But really, it's that time in the desert that shapes and forges him. Again, lots and lots of science fiction books are dealing with, right? Starship Troopers takes this up, and Ender's Game. I mean, it's basically the plot of Ender's Game is, you know, how much can you brutalize a 7-year-old until he's, you know, a great general? Which, you know, I don't recommend as parenting advice, but it is still an important political question. So that when the real challenge comes, you have a generation of people who are ready to face that, and I assume that the sequels go into some of this. One of the problems with the Emperor's elites is that they've gotten sort of complacent and lazy. So they've become more cruel than they are sort of well-trained anymore because there's no real competition for them. Because, yeah, they have to go through this planet, but once they're off the planet, now they're the biggest people on the block. And until they run into the Fremen, there's no... there's no real competition for them. I think the implication is the same thing is eventually going to happen to the Fremen. Mm-hmm. And, once they're out there, once they're the new Imperial shock troops, they're also going to get lazy and complacent. And some discussion is had of that.
Yeah, at the end, when Paul is sort of negotiating peace with the Emperor, which is basically, you're going to go live on your prison planet, and I'm going to be emperor. That's the peace. Right. And you're going to give me all your money. I mean, he has him over a barrel there. He says something along those lines. He says, you know, we're going to make Arrakis a beautiful place, but there was always going to be the desert here as well, right? And so they're leaving space for the worms and, like, these kind of figures of death.
Spice,
right?
Production.
Spice, yeah. Production. But also, I mean, as a kind of toughening agent, you get the idea that every chapter opens with an epigraph from some mythical book told about Muad'Dib from the distant future. And so one of the quotes from him has something to do with being spoiled on Caladan, and so there's an awareness on his part that that's a danger, and he seems to be, as he's engineering the future, building in this toughening agents so that to address that. Who knows whether it works or not, but yeah. But you're right.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the equivalent today of you know, let's have some kind of cultural rule that says until you're, you know, 30, 40 years old, you don't get to have the modern American middle-class lifestyle. You live at sort of Great Depression era levels of work and sustenance and so on.
Yeah.
And you have to sort of earn your way in. Could that be engineered into society? Well, none of us want to do that.
Yeah.
But if that's what's necessary for building, you know, a virtuous and competent generation, I mean, should it matter whether or not we want to do it? And I don't have an answer there.
Yeah. Like I said, I think this is written in the throes of, like, still, like, progressivism. I mean, I'm talking about, like, in the, like, sort of New Deal version, like, the Great Society is coming around in this time, right? And so you've got this sense that the smart guys in the room can engineer the future. Everybody else is going to deny the individual in favor of the corporate, right? And the Fremen are, I mean, just engineered for this from their own culture. I mean, they're sitting on oceans of water, right? That they're not drinking because they're saving it for this future time, for the utopia their great 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 grandchildren are going to. I mean, nobody, it's hard to imagine that kind of collectivist idea gaining any traction today, right? And so it has this and it's only possible really with the kind of religious fervor that Muad'Dib is able to inspire in his people. I mean, he's the one who's able to unite all of this discipline into a targeted direction, right? And so
And that's where, as a political scientist and as, you know, a Christian with Christian convictions, that's where I say, that's probably the least realistic part of the book, because what's going to happen is, A, you'll have people stealing water all the time.
Yeah.
And B, you're going to have some demagogue who comes along and says, why should we be saving this water up for, you know, 5,000 years from now? Let's go and drink it now. We deserve our share.
But Social Security. I mean, we can't even keep Social Security. Right? I mean, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. But it's got that kind of optimism. And this kind of long-term vision. It also reminds me actually of, Isaac Asimov's Foundation. I don't know if you
read that. That's fantastic.
We should
do that one someday.
Yeah, I would love that. I love Foundation. And I've only read I've read bits of a lot of them because they're very kind of vignettes, right? There's kind of tiny little episodic stories. But the idea for everybody who isn't aware of this is you get this great mind, a guy named Harry Seldon, I think his name, if I remember right. He sees that the Empire, which is running swimmingly, it's perfect. Everybody thinks everything's awesome, but he can see that in 100 years, it's all going to collapse because of, he's like an academic who has this kind of, this rubric or this, this log algorithm that he's observing, and he sees where everything is headed. And he assembles this team of academics And he basically engineers the next 10,000 years of human history, right? And so he understands what's going to happen in, I forget the name of his discipline.
It's like psychohistory. Like
I think
that.
That's it. Yeah. So he's a combination of a lot of academic disciplines where he's able to sort of predict the future, thousands and thousands of years from now. And so he's able to set things up so that in that amount of time, things will be good again, right? And so that's something in the spirit of the 60s, where you have this this idea that we could really do that if we just put our mind to it. And now, like, I just don't have much faith in technology, because, I mean, you think about all the – I was just thinking about this. I'm trying to put together some instructional videos for this little program I run here at Mount Aloysius College, and I was just looking at different options for doing this, and, like, how much brain power is going into making a 17th version of PowerPoint, right? You know, I mean, we just are spinning our wheels with technology, and it's not aimed at anything actually good or innovative or that's actually going to substantively change the world, right? All we want to do is, like, spin our wheels. And that's another reason why reading this book is kind of enthralling, because you get a sense of mission, right? This long-term vision. Everybody together in unison can work together. I mean, in this way, it's got this kind of quasi-Marxist utopian view of history, right? I don't know. I just feel like reading this book is enthralling, but it's also a little depressing when you see what we're actually doing with the stupid inventions that we're making now.
Well, and not to get too much into the Foundation trilogy, but man, if I were going to build like an isolated commune, if I were going to go Benedict option on the United States, right, and start a little society out of the way, the last people I would gather together would be academics, because they're not the people I want building my house and, you know, putting up fences and herding cattle and so on. So, I mean, send me a plumber, you know.
But he gathers these academics and takes them off the grid, right? I mean, I mean, I think that's the key, is to pull us out of our institutions. Like the Bene Gesserit, they're so enthralled with their own institution, they lose sight of the big picture, right? And so academia is the same way now. We're all worried about our little piece of the pie that – writing a journal article that 27 other people might read, only to cite in their article that 14 other people might read. And so,
it's Lord of the Flies is much more accurate, I think, than the Foundation trilogy. But
unlike a podcast where there's at least like 48 people listening, and so
I tell people we have 2,000 to 3,000 listeners. So I know that's true for like the main one. I have absolutely no concept of whether or not that's true for any of our shows. So
if you're listening out there, you better spread the word so we're not wasting our time. So anyway. One other political thing, though, that really stands out to me about this book is mine was almost 800 pages, and I didn't actually get to the appendices. There's a whole bunch of appendices that I didn't read. There's like another 150 pages of that I didn't get to. But I got into the late 700s, and part of the reason that this book is this long is that it goes into excruciating detail about political performance and like subtlety and reading other people's motions, and like somebody will like, oh, he lifted his thumb, that must mean he's considering this, and we get all of that kind of internal backstory about reading a political moment, right, and trying to engineer it for a given end. Like half of the book is really about that, and it's kind of a fascinating, almost rhetorical exercise to watch the way that everything is subtextual in this book. I mean, very, very rarely does this person's spoken words, at least in the empire world, actually reflect their inner goals, right? That's all sort of coded language that everybody's understanding at the same time. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and throw in a plug for the appendices in your spare time. You find out the backstory of the planetologist Kynes.
Yeah.
His backstory, some of the religious backstory, and then some of the stuff about space travel. And then there's one that's like it's a glossary or something. Like, you don't need to read that. But I mean, it actually, they are sort of mini pseudo short stories in and of themselves, and they do fill out pretty well some of the stuff. But yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of this is very much ceremony and form.
That's the word I'm looking for. Ceremony. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, that goes along with, like you said earlier, the religious side of things. They were just going through the motions, not realizing that those ceremonies actually mattered.
Yeah.
Right? They were legitimate reflections of a reality that, they had no conception of other than as a political tool to further their own ends.
Yeah. In a horror film, it would be like people playing with a Ouija board for fun, not knowing they're actually conjuring demons, right? And so
right.
I think in a lot of ways you've got the same thing going on here with the ceremony that gets – I mean, everything is ceremony. Like everything is – I have to follow the script, and what a successful person in this political world knows is that script, right? And Paul brings that knowledge and combines it with this kind of wild pre-modern sensibility of the Freeman, and combines that with this kind of religious instruction from the Bene Gesserit, and he has this, I mean, he uses what's already existing to create something utterly new, and I think that it's just as an exercise in political ceremony and form, as you say, I just think it's a fascinating book to read. It can get a little tedious because there's a lot of passages where it's just one person saying something, and then in italics, what he was really thinking was he was looking for this kind of result. And so it's a really kind of meticulous depiction of that kind of political ceremony, but it's fascinating.
Well, yeah, and I think it's interesting that you're right, that he brings all of this together and creates something new. And literally what he creates is jihad.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, it's sort of the there's all of this optimism and all of this sort of progressive politics, and the end result is not pleasant.
No.
Right? And again, this I have not read them. From what I understand, this is really worked out in later books, in even more excruciating detail, because he gets more and more detailed, but also yeah, the jihad takes off, and it is exactly as Paul's vision said it would be.
Yeah,
and necessary to continue the survival of the human species. You've got to sort of wipe out all of these people along the way.
The decadence of this kind of ceremonial culture has to be sort of wiped away. And what's interesting is that Paul, at one point, he has these kind of when he consumes too much spice, inflames these kind of psychic abilities that he has, quasi-psychic abilities. And so he gets into these trances where he sees a million possible futures, kind of, right? Like Doctor Strange in Infinity War. And so, sees jihad and tries everything he can to avoid it because he's learned to kind of hate violence. When he killed that Freeman in ceremony in ritual combat, he's made immediately to feel guilty about that, so he doesn't come to enjoy violence, right? And yet he knows it's inescapable, and he even knows, even if I die now, the jihad is coming because of the legend I'm leaving behind, right? And so, he knows that everything he does takes on this mythical religious quality that further inflames the jihad, and he's aware of that. And so having that knowledge while he's doing all the political machinations is really thought-provoking. I gotta say, it's a fascinating book. And also, on that note, the book seems to suggest that this isn't a purely political project. There is something supernatural behind it. The final battle where he retakes the palace on Arrakis, as the Duke, who's the rightful heir to this palace, is aided by this giant sandstorm that they basically use to, as part of their battles plan, right? It's almost like God himself is behind this. And I feel like it's a really interesting, kind of harrowing Old Testament God sort of wrath, right? And he's just sort of the instrument of wrath.
Yeah. And if I remember right, it covers their use of nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah.
They, which I guess there's some more technology, although again, very retrograde.
Yeah,
I
mean, atomics, they call them, right? And so, yeah, the rule is you're not allowed to use atomics on people. And so Paul plays it political. He says, well, I didn't use atomics on people. I blew up this wall that was protecting you from the sandstorm. So he used the atomics to blow up this protective shield that allowed the sandstorm to go blow into their encampment and wipe them out and give them cover as they followed it in to continue to wipe them out. And so, yeah, so he does, they do have atomic weapons, but it is, which also I remember from Foundation, there's a point at which people are freaked out by the thought that someone else might have atomic weapons, right? So that, right. Yeah, it's apparently we're never going to move past that. So now with the Space Force coming, so.
Yeah, that I guess that I don't know when this episode will drop, but that tells you when we're recording it. So we've been talking a lot about politics. I see we're at about an hour, so we probably shouldn't stretch this out too much. We've been talking a lot about politics. There is a lot more in this book. I mean, there are meditations on wisdom versus knowledge. There are meditations on the role of love in human existence. A lot of what we're saying doesn't sort of crystallize until so even after Paul drinks the water of life and, you know, sort of gains this ultimate knowledge, this knowledge of the future and this access to all the wisdom of the past, even then things aren't sort of sharpened for him until he confesses his love to this girl and arranges a few. I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things going on here. It's not as sappy as it sounds. Like there's more to it than that. So go read the book and enjoy it. It's fantastic. But what is not fantastic, and what I want to just spend a minute or two talking about, are the movies. So there have been, I guess, two and a half movies made about this. So the originally, and I should have kept this guy's name in front of me. Originally, there was going to be a Dune movie directed by Jodorowsky. Am I saying that right?
I don't know.
Okay, a director named Jodorowsky, and it was apparently going to be this epic thing. And I should have kept the details. It was supposed to be, you know, Pink Floyd was going to do the music for it. It was going to be you know, cast with all these A-list casters, and the Hollywood suits basically freaked out and wouldn't let him make it. Salvador Dali was going to play someone. Orson Welles was cast for it. David Carradine, Mick Jagger. I mean, it was going to be this sort of epic event that would have predated Star Wars. So it would have come out before Star Wars. That didn't work. So again, for various political reasons. So about a decade later, in 1984, David Lynch filmed a Dune movie. It also had a lot of A-listers. Sting played the bad guy, along with who was Harkonnen in that? Kenneth McMillan. If you don't know the name, look him up, and he'll seem familiar. Patrick Stewart was in it. Kyle MacLachlan played Paul. Virginia Madsen, Sean Young, Brad Dourif. I mean, it Max von Sydow. You know, there was a basically all of the major 1980s people were in this movie. It also had, I forget who did the music on it, but it also had it. I don't think it was Sting, even though he was in the movie. It also had this great soundtrack. I mean, it was going to be the movie of the decade, and it was just a giant drag. And I think I would blame David Lynch for that, because I think his movies are terrible. I think he is best when confined to the limits of network television. I think that's when he's sort of at his best. So I think the original Twin Peaks was fantastic. I think when he's given sort of free range, his weirdness takes over too much. I might be wrong about that. You're free to yell at me online if you want to. He says that the problem is that, once again, the Hollywood suits got involved, and they took this movie that he filmed and chopped it up beyond all recognition. So he actually had them take his name off of it. Everyone knew he'd done it, but he forced them to take his name off the movie. I think by sort of general consensus, it is terrible. It's just an awful, awful movie. So about 20 years later, the Sci-Fi Channel did a miniseries, like a five-part, something like that miniseries. It's okay. It's worth watching. It's much more faithful to the book than the 1984 version is. I don't know that I'd say it's spectacular or anything like that, but it is worth picking up. Danny, have you seen any of these?
I have not, but I also think that the time is now right for something. I mean, with long-form television programming formats, sure. I feel like we've finally gotten to a place where you can do this justice, and whether it's a Netflix series or whatever, take some time, have an episode that's just about looking at someone's body language, right? And we're sort of prepared for that now, I think, as an audience, because of this rather new form of consumption of media consumption. And so, yeah, I really do feel like the time is, I mean, you think, look at something like Westworld on HBO.
Right.
I mean, even thematically, I think that we're kind of interested in this. And honestly, in the age of Trump, I really do think, I mean, there's something really politically still fascinating about strongman politics. I think it's more, we're more ready for this now than we were in the 80s, I think. And so I think that this is the time to do something like that. I don't know. I thought I'd heard somebody is working on kind of jumping into Dune again, but I don't know.
I mean, maybe. I have read, and I'll post this article, that we actually got the Dune movie we wanted, and it was the original Star Wars movie, which, as you pointed out, desert planet, empire coming in.
Yeah.
Technology is there, but it's sort of ignored in favor of the religious and political and so on. So, yeah.
It's very true.
I think there's something to that.
Yeah. Before we go, can I just give a plug, sure, for two other things? On the religious thing, one last thing. It's... my assumption is this takes place, like, these are our descendants, like 10,000 years from now or something.
Yes.
Like that, right? And because they're drawing on kind of our wisdom, they quote something called the OC Bible, which is the Orange Catholic Bible, which is this, I don't know, you get the sense that in the future, our religious traditions get kind of jumbled up, kind of, and they find some synthesis for our descendants in this. And they draw on, I mean, pretty solid wisdom from our religious texts. So, I mean, Orange Catholic, I'm assuming this is sort of a meld of the Catholic and the Protestant, right? And so...
yeah, had you read the appendix,
okay,
you would know that... what Herbert says in the appendix is that basically all religions had to deal with the reality of space travel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was such a... literally earth-shakingly big event that had to be worked out. So various ecumenical commissions were called to sort of work out what is the true revelation from God in light of the existence of space travel to other planets, and so on. Which, interestingly, Herbert, there are no aliens in Dune.
Right.
I suppose you might count the worms are... not from Earth creatures,
not,
maybe.
Like sentient aliens. There's not like like civilizations.
So Herbert's claim is that just space travel alone is different and traumatic enough to merit that sort of revaluation. Whereas other science fiction authors are big on, no, it's sentient life, right? It's rational life elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's going to be the big sort of forcing us to stop it. I mean, even C.S. Lewis had something to say about that,
yeah,
in his space trilogy. So they go into a little bit about how the Orange Catholic Bible was put together and some of the politics behind it, because, of course,
yeah,
it's still political.
And then Paul ends up being essentially Muhammad, you know what I mean? And it's fascinating. It's a really fascinating kind of religious landscape. So in addition to the politics and the gender and all the other things, I think that the religious aspect of this is really kind of profound and fascinating, in addition to all the sort of pagan sort of ancestor worship that's kind of going on as well. And finally, I'm an English prof. I just want to kind of give some, solids to Herbert's writing. I think that the book is structured. I mean, there's some beautiful passages that go into a person's mind as they're dying, right? We get this omniscient perspective that is like really used in a, like, just, I don't know how to say it, a really effective way, because lots of characters sort of die throughout this, and we get their consciousness as they're dying, and we understand the big picture, they don't, right? And so we're seeing how their part of the story wraps up, and like Kynes, when Kynes dies, it's a really fascinating, I mean, he's left in this utter moment of uncertainty about what's going to happen. We kind of know, largely because of the epigraphs and things like that. But by him entering into a person's consciousness at the moment of their death and then zooming back out into another person's consciousness when they're evaluating some political move by somebody else, just jumping around from consciousness to consciousness is handled really deftly, and I think it adds a lot to this book. And it actually reminds me a lot of Children of Men. If I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. I love that movie, and I want to do a show on that sometime. But that nobody, lots of people just die, like in that movie, and their part of the story just ends, right? When they have no sense of how their death fits into the bigger picture, right? Kynes' death, I mean, it's just, I'm dying and I have no idea what it means, but it's super important. His life and his contribution was super important, and he will never know that, right? And that same thing happens in Children of Men. These people just sort of come into the story, help it along, and then die, right? And so, and without ever having known, without the resolution or the comfort of their big piece of the puzzle. And that to me is just really profound and moving. When Duke Leto dies, when Kynes dies, when there's lots of other people who sort of die, and we just sort of hear their final thoughts, and it's just, I don't know, it's chilling and it's moving, I got to give him some credit as a writer. This is a really well written novel.
And one of the downfalls of the 1984 movie is that they include some of that in voiceovers, and it's just weird and awkward and heavy-handed. And
there are probably better and worse ways to do that, for sure.
Well, they picked a worse way. And with that, anything else to add about Dune, Danny? Otherwise,
no,
we should.
I want to thank you for having me read it and inviting me on the show to talk about it. I loved it. It was just a fantastic book. I'm a better person for having read it.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I went a walk in that ribbon of highway.